What happens when Harry Bosch teams up with a Lincoln lawyer? Michael Connelly will join us to talk about The Crossing, his latest book in his best-selling Harry Bosch series.
I was looking for, this is almost the journalist in me, I was looking to find a character that could take us into those worlds, and I could do some reporting about how our justice system actually does work, or in many cases doesn't work.
Who were the men behind the spy novels? Joseph Cannon, no stranger to the subject, will be here to talk about a new biography of John le Carré and the memoir of Frederick Forsyth.
This is like being in a pub with somebody who wants to tell you stories, and you know you have better things to do and worthier things to do, but he's so charming and he keeps refilling your glass, and before you know it, you've had a very pleasant evening, you know.
Alexander Alter will give us an update from the literary world. Greg Coles has bestseller news. We'll also let readers and listeners weigh in with a few comments of their own. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Michael Connelly joins us now from L.A. He is the author, most recently, of The Crossing, which is called a Bosch novel, but is both a Bosch novel and a Lincoln lawyer novel. Michael, thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be on.
For those who have not read any Bosch novels, tell us about your protagonist, Hieronymus Bosch.
Well, Harry Bosch is a detective with the Los Angeles Police Department homicide in most of the novels. There's been 20 novels, and, you know, if I had to boil him down to one word, it would be relentless. A few more words is that he kind of operates by this a really strong code of fairness. Everybody counts or nobody counts.
Mm-hmm.
And this in the 20th novel where he shows up, he's actually not with the LAPD. He's been retired. He just retired, was kind of forced out, and was approached by his half-brother, who he doesn't have the greatest relationship with because he's a defense lawyer known as the Lincoln Lawyer. And he's approached to work on a case where Mickey Haller, his half-brother, is really sure that he is a client who's innocent of the murder charge that he's facing, and wants someone like Harry Bosch, a relentless investigator, looking into it. And it's a little bit about Harry being drawn into it and about Harry dealing with the idea of crossing the aisle. You get the title in there.
Mm-hmm.
Crossing the aisle and working for the defense after 30-some years of being a detective, being a police officer and a detective.
For those readers, again, who might not be familiar with Harry Bosch, I have to ask the obvious question, which is, how on earth did his parents, or why did they name him Hieronymus Bosch, and why did you decide to name him that and to call him Harry?
Well, you know, this goes back about 25 years when I was first putting the character together. You know, most writers, like me, start out as voracious readers and study the craft. I study the genre, crime fiction, and I know that, you know, great plots are very important, but it really comes down to character. It's whether the reader can connect with a character. And, you know, so you never miss a chance to say something about character, and that would include a name. So I thought long and hard about what I would name this detective, and I actually went through a couple different names, and then I remembered a painter I had studied way back in college in a humanities class, and we spent several weeks studying the work of the 15th century painter Hieronymus Bosch. And the work is dark, it's chaotic, it's about a world gone wrong. And most of the descriptions you can come up with for the paintings, you could also use on a crime scene, a murder scene. And so that was the connection, I thought, that this detective I'm writing about is going to look at worlds gone wrong and figure out what went wrong and figure out what happened and how to make it right. And so it's a bit of a stretch, but there was a metaphoric connection there. And so I named him Hieronymus Bosch, Harry for short.
Well, yeah, of course he's got to have a strong nickname with a name like Hieronymus.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is that Hieronymus' short name sounded like Harry to me. I then later found out once when I went on a book tour in Holland where the real painter was from, that that name is the Latin root of Jerome. So I guess I should have called him Jerry, but I think Harry sounds better.
Maybe in the translated version. You said it comes down to character. You have another one of your very strong characters in this book, the Lincoln Lawyer. Tell us about Mickey Haller.
Mickey Haller, he's more of a recent addition to the characters I write about. I was always looking for a, kind of a flip side to Harry Bosch, somebody on the other side of the aisle. I spent a lot of time as a journalist in courtrooms and was always fascinated by the stuff that goes on outside of the actual hearings or the trials, and the strategies and the shortcuts and things like that. And so I was looking for, this is almost a journalist in me, I was looking to find a character that could take us into those worlds and I could do some reporting about how our justice system actually does work or in many cases doesn't work. And it kind of came out of that, and this was always like a goal of mine. I was thinking I would like to do this, and then one day I got very lucky and was at a baseball game sitting next to a stranger, and during the course of the game we started talking, and he told me he was a defense lawyer and that he worked out of his car because in Los Angeles there are so many courthouses and the geography is spread so wide that he found that being mobile and being able to work as he moved between these courthouses and horrible traffic and so forth and being driven by a driver was the best way to practice law, the defense law in Los Angeles. And so the light bulb went off and I kind of had that outline of a character to do this other thing I wanted to do, which was explore in fiction, you know, the justice system here.
And the first Lincoln Lawyer novel came out when?
2005.
And how many have there been so far?
You know, it's weird how you got to classify stuff as a Bosch novel or a Lincoln Lawyer. I mean, they're in several books together. So this book, The Crossing, I believe is the sixth book that Mickey Haller plays a significant part in. But there's been a few other books where he's in it for like a page, or one book he's only in it for a paragraph. But six books where he makes a pretty solid appearance or carries the whole story.
So I've got to ask you this question. I think many people consider The Lincoln Lawyer and then you indirectly as being responsible for the reviving the career of Matthew McConaughey. Do you see Matthew McConaughey now when you're writing Mickey?
It's interesting because McConaughey, I mean, I think he did a wonderful job in the movie. And he's the age of the character that I'm writing about. So, yeah, he has infiltrated my creative mind, I guess you'd say. So when I was writing this book, The Crossing, when I was writing about Haller, I was seeing McConaughey. So he's really kind of grabbed that character in my head. But conversely, Harry Bosch, there's also a TV show where Harry Bosch is played by a really fine actor named Titus Welliver. But the Bosch I write about in The Crossing is 15 years older than the guy on the TV show, and so it's quite a different Harry Bosch. And so therefore, Titus Welliver has not infiltrated my creative mind when I'm writing the Bosch novels, but oddly enough, McConaughey has.
Did McConaughey's performance bring something to the character that you hadn't previously sort of thought about?
You know, it's interesting. It was like in the quiet moments. There's a lot of moments in the movie where Haller/McConaughey is just observing or receiving information and the kind of looks he made. You know, those kind of things don't get in books. That did really impress me. So I really kind of obviously got like a full visual impact of this character that, you know, I had created on the page. Now you see him in flesh and blood.
So you'd retired Harry Bosch from his 30-year career in Homicide. Did you know what was going to happen to him once you did that? Did you know that he was going to cross over, or how did that idea come about?
No, I really, you know, I don't think too far ahead. I mean, I have confidence that I will come up with something. I mean, I knew when I retired last year's book, The Burning Room, Bosch leaves at the end. He walks through the door of the detective bureau. You know, and as I wrote that scene, I knew that was it. He was gone. Did I think he was gone from the pages of what I do? No, not at all. I'm really fascinated by that character. And I just thought, you know, he's walking out, he's turning in his badge, and this is an opportunity for something new or a new direction, and I wasn't sure what I would do, but I knew I would do it. You know, I knew something would come to me. And, you know, you also in plant seeds and books, you know, like he has a daughter who wants to be a cop and she's almost old enough to do that. You know, so I have stuff planted that could bring Harry Bosch into many different stories in different ways. But, you know, when I finished the last book and wrote The End, I wasn't sure what would be next. And and it's The Crossing, but, you know, that just kind of came to me.
Let's talk about the story at the center of The Crossing. There's a reformed gangbanger who's accused of a murder. Who is he, and who's accused of murdering?
What happens is Mickey Haller is defending this reformed gangbanger named Daquan, and he's charged with killing a public official, assistant city manager in West Hollywood, someone it doesn't make sense that he would even cross paths with, but there's a DNA match, which is, you know, in criminal prosecution, a DNA match, is almost gold. And so he's up for this or facing this charge, and Haller thinks there's enough stuff wrong with the case that he's suspicious. He's a cynical guy. Most of the, 95% or even higher of his clients are usually facing charges that are warranted. And so when he hits a possible innocent guy, it really kind of turns his head. And so that's why I wanted to bring in Harry Bosch. The inspiration, this goes back to that I know what I would do, was a retired homicide detective told me about a case where someone was framed for a murder by someone who brought in to the crime scene foreign DNA to throw the cops off. And I thought, that is kind of an amazing story. And so from that conversation with that retired detective, this whole thing kind of came about.
I don't want to get into too many plot spoilers, so we won't go too far beyond that in terms of describing The Crossing and its plot. But you did say that you don't think too far ahead, and yet you have planted seeds in the Bosch novels. You mentioned Harry Bosch's daughter, an aspiring detective. Do you know what you're going to do next? Have you already written the next book?
No, I haven't really. What I try to do is start writing a book every December. And so I'm right in the stage, obviously, in about 4 or 5 weeks, I'm going to start writing the next book. And I'm really being honest when I say I don't know what it is. Now, I have an idea for a Bosch book. I have an idea for a Mickey Haller book. But what's really tempting me is I have an idea for a whole new character and a different story that is really pulling me. I just kind of feel like, Lincoln Lawyer was the last main character, new main character I created, and now that's 10 years ago. So I kind of feel almost obligated as someone who has this opportunity to tell stories, and there's publishers who want my books and hopefully readers, that, not to keep doing the same old, and to at least every now and then come up with something new, and that creative instinct is really taking hold of me. So my guess is that in December I'm going to head off on writing something new.
Who's the new character?
I'm not sure I want to say yet, because in case this doesn't happen and I hold it for another year, I want to keep it quiet. But I'll say this, I write in the genre of crime fiction, and so I write about people who either directly or have jobs where they're involved in ferreting out, mysteries, unanswered questions. And so it's still in that line. I'm not saying I'm going to suddenly write, a romance novel or something like that. It would be, very generically, I would say it's a private investigator, but what I want to not discuss is the specialty that this investigator has.
All right. Well, very appropriately mysterious. Michael Connelly, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate the interest.
Michael Connelly is the author of the Harry Bosch novels, of the Lincoln Lawyer series, and his latest, The Crossing, brings together both of those two. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Alexandra Alter is here now with Notes from the Literary World. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
We've got Halloween coming up tomorrow.
Yes. Do you want to talk about our scariest writer in this country, Stephen King?
I always want to talk about Stephen King.
So Stephen King has a new short story collection coming out next week, which I'm sure his fans are aware of. And it's a lot of the stories have been published elsewhere. But what's interesting about this collection is that first of all, he rewrote and polished a lot of them up, but he also provided these introductions to each of the stories about where he got the idea and what the inspiration was and what his motivation was.
And I think that's what so many people want to know about Stephen King.
This is exactly what I wanted to know about him. And it's funny because he gets asked so often where he gets his ideas, and he usually says he gets them at the used ideas shop in Utica because he says it's such a mysterious process, he can't possibly answer that. It's almost like dreaming. But he gives it a shot, and it's pretty fascinating to see where some of these wild and terrifying stories come from. For example, there's one story titled The Dune, which is like a classic Stephen King freaky story about a sand dune where a name will mysteriously appear and the person will die. And a judge in Florida discovers this sand dune and doesn't really know what to do with the information. In his introduction, he said he got the idea when he was walking his dog on the beach in Florida.
That doesn't happen to everyone who walks their dog
exactly.
on a beach in Florida.
Most of us are sort of just relaxing or looking at the sunset.
Yeah, some of us have peaceful, happy thoughts walking dogs in the dunes of Florida.
And he says the story just came to him beginning, middle, and end, and he wrote it in 2 days. Another one that came out of what can be a more mundane thing, a rest stop in Maine, just had been closed up, and he drove by it. Most people drive by the rest stop, maybe think, oh, it's too bad
pee.
It's closed, I'm hungry. Yeah. For Stephen King, he imagines that there is a monster car that, you know, devours people alive that's parked at the rest stop. So that's another classic kind of Stephen King story. And the other thing that struck me about this collection, and I did interview him, and he said this was very deliberate when he picked the stories that went in here. There's a whole range of styles and genres. I mean, he has some of his typically scary and wild stories, but there's a lot of realistic stories in there. He says some of them were inspired by writers like Raymond Carver and Elmore Leonard and John Irving, and you really see kind of his stylistic range more than you often do. And I think that was a conscious thing on his part because he does feel like he's been pigeonholed as a horror writer, and he wants to show people all that he's capable of. So that's kind of interesting, too.
Something tells me we won't be seeing love stories from him anytime soon.
No romances in here, but
all right,
that's probably the one genre he hasn't touched yet.
What's the title of the new book?
It's called The Bazaar of Bad Dreams, mm-hmm. and it definitely gave me some.
All right. It's reviewed this week in the book review by Terrence Rafferty. Thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks, Pamela.
Joseph Cannon joins us now. He is the author, most recently, of the novel Leaving Berlin and other excellent spy novels. And he is here to talk about spy novels and the people who write them. Hi, Joe.
Good to see you.
So you reviewed this week two books, a memoir and a biography, John le Carré, the biography by Adam Sisman, and The Outsider, My Life in Intrigue by Frederick Forsyth. Let's start off just by talking about le Carré. What role does le Carré play in the landscape of the spy novel?
Oh, I think he's universally seen to be as the grand master. I mean, everyone is compared with him, either favorably or unfavorably, mostly unfavorably. He's the man. You know, he essentially created the modern espionage thriller. There were two novels that preceded Spy Who Came In from the Cold, but Spy was a landmark in its day in 1963. And in America, early 64, when it was a sensation. And I think it changed forever the way we approach espionage novels and the kind of moral inquiry that he brings to it. It wasn't just a fast-paced, interestingly plotted entertainment. This was something serious, and he was after a lot more.
What were spy novels like before le Carré?
I don't mean to suggest that there were no good novels. I mean, Eric Ambler was writing. Certainly Graham Greene's entertainments are even today, hailed and read. But I think it was mostly relegated to genre fiction, and there were a lot of unambitious mm-hmm. books that were in that field. Nobody was quite grasping. I mean, often they would hark back to World War II where things were crystal clear. It was only le Carré that brings the Cold War into it with all the gray moral ambiguity. I once said that I was talking to somebody about the change in thrillers and the impact that the war had. And I think that, use a movie metaphor, at the beginning of the war, it's Casablanca. Everything is black and white and crystal clear. And you
good
know
guys
exactly
and bad guys.
You bet. And you know when to sing the Marseillaise, etc. But the war ends with The Third Man, where everything is now murky, not quite as clear-cut as it should be. And that's the world we inherited, and very much the world that le Carré inherited. He joined MI5 in 1958 at the very height of the Cold War.
Right.
He was in MI5 for 2 years and MI6 abroad in Bonn for 2.5.
For anyone who hasn't sort of watched their all their spy movies or read their spy novels, we should clarify that MI5 is sort of the UK equivalent of
the FBI. It's charged with domestic security and preventing spies from spying in England. MI6 is the CIA. Mm-hmm. It's adventurism. It's running agents abroad.
James Bond.
James Bond, and much more fun. And in fact, he transferred out of MI5 because he thought it was a sort of dead end kind of office life, and it would be much more exciting to be at MI6. Ironically, that's now the period that he doesn't really want to talk about, even though I'm sure all of his fans would like to hear more detail about it. But it's not really a failing of the book. I think that Sisman has done a terrific job in this biography, and he certainly conveys what life was like if you were in MI6 in the late 50s, early 60s.
Well, Le Carré, I think after this book came out or was about to come out, announced that he was, of course, going to write his own memoir to come out next year. So it sounds like he's going to cover those bits that you say in your review Sisman is unable to get out of him, which is his... what happened when
right.
he was...
He's reluctant to talk about the Bonn years and Bonn, Germany, where he was posted. And, you know, it's possible that not a great deal actually happened. I mean, we are, in a sense, making it up for him.
Right.
But it's possible that things did. I don't know that it matters one way or the other. Emotionally and morally, Sisman gets it right. He gets what Le Carré used to inform the books. He mm-hmm. gets the kind of level of moral inquiry, as I said before, that really is responsible for making these books better and out of genre. I mean, there's an age-old debate about whether he transcends the genre. I think it's a sort of ridiculous debate. The fact is, he's just a wonderful writer.
Right.
And a very important one.
I think there's a blurb by Philip Roth that often runs on the back of his books that says, you know, simply one of the best novelists of our time without the, you know, spy or espionage in front of it.
And I couldn't agree more. And I also think it's true of Philip Roth. So it works.
I think that even though he apparently didn't talk to Sisman about what happened during those years when he was an active spy, it sounds like his life, his real life otherwise, was not uneventful. Tell us about his childhood.
Not uneventful. The childhood, as I say in the review, is something out of Dickens. The father is this incorrigible scoundrel and con man who's involved in one swindling scheme after another. When times are good, he owns horse races and he has chauffeured limousines, and his two sons, one of whom is Le Carré, whose real name is David Cornwell, are treated like princes, and everything is wonderful, and the father has louche nightclub performers over to parties and, you know, cricket teams, etc. When things are not so good, he's in bankruptcy court. He's not paying the school fees for the sons, who are deeply embarrassed by this because word always gets around. It was a very traumatic childhood. Le Carré once said that getting out from under Ronnie, mm-hmm. if I ever did, is the story of my life. I think that's true, and I think the biography certainly takes that attitude. But it's equally important to think about the mother in this.
She left when he was five?
The mother left when Le Carré was five and his brother was 7 or 8. And, you know, I think he's 2 or 3 years older. Le Carré seems to remember her coming up to kiss him goodnight, to say goodbye. But in fact, he now does not know whether this is a real memory or just something that he would have liked to have imagined. Anyway, she left. He did not see her again until he was, I think, 23, I mean, a grown-up. And he sought her out because he wanted to make
contact.
What was
that encounter like?
As awkward as you might imagine, mm-hmm. On his part, not so awkward on hers. She seems to have been not as troubled by this as one might imagine. And it's a shock to discover as you're flipping these pages and thinking, well, what was this like for him? Clearly traumatic. He was sent off to boarding school, but he would have anyway. I mean, that was an English habit. And it was, as per usual, terrible. And the headmaster had a riding whip. And, you know, it's the usual English public school kind of experience. But it was particularly difficult for him because he had been abandoned by the mother. What's extraordinary is that you learn a few pages later that even though she never saw the boys again while mm-hmm. they were children, she continued to meet the father with whom she was besotted, and they would have little trysts in London, even though she was supposedly with another man. She then later moved to Canada, so there were years in which they would not have seen each other. It wasn't really a question of election. She was just gone. Le Carre was, I think, in the end, very dutiful to her. I don't know that he, quote, loved her, but he stood up to the plate when she was. He paid for the nursing home when she was ill. He bought her a house to live in. He supported her, essentially, when she came back from Canada and was aging, none of which he had to do.
There's this ongoing theme in his childhood then of this sort of double life, his father's double life, his own double life, the kind of rapidly changing personal circumstance.
Very much so. And with him, what you get is this push-pull of being attracted to the edge, living on the edge, that kind of danger, and yet fleeing from it and wanting stability and wanting respectability. He has a very early marriage, for instance, which ultimately fails. And it's partly this drive to, he wants this home life. He subsequently would have endless, apparently, short-term affairs, and both wives knew about them. His current wife, in fact, the second, said at one point, well, nobody will ever have all of David.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, well, okay, you know. What it represents is, on the one hand, this kind of thrill of having a secret, this thrill of going toward the edge away, and then always coming back home.
Right.
And always being that stable figure.
How did he go from MI6 to becoming a novelist?
He was at MI6 when he started writing. We are told that he had done some teaching before he went into the Secret Service. And while he was doing that, he was working on a novel about a school, but he put it aside. He then had some time on his hands when he was in Bonn. I don't think it was as fraught a station as might be. Certainly in a small town in Germany, people had a lot of time. And he started writing a novel. And it became Call for the Dead, his first novel, for which I think he got £100, you know, as the advance. These were very different times. He took a pseudonym because if you were in the Secret Services, you couldn't publish under your own name.
How did he come up with John Le Carre?
It is said, the legend is that he was on a bus and he was passing some storefront and there was this name and he thought, well, that's a very odd name. But who knows what the real truth is.
It's one of those things. I guess we'll find out in his memoir next year.
Yes, if true. You know, it's one of those things that's often misremembered. What I found really amusing is that Victor Golans, who was his first publisher, really preferred a kind of tough guy American name and was proposing, instead of Le Carre, which would sound European and effete, that he would be Chuck Smith or Hank Brown. You know, if that had been the case, imagine. Tinker Tailor by Hank Smith.
Yeah, it doesn't sound quite the same. You have your own experience as a former publisher of Houghton Mifflin, as well as a reader. How does this hold up as a literary biography? Sort of, what do you think is the ideal literary biography, and how does this fall into?
This is good. This is a first-rate book, and I think it's very much the, you know, no subject is ever truly pleased with his or her biography, because you always want it to be more heroic and wonderful than it turns out to be. But I think Le Carre should, on the whole, be very pleased with this, because the one overriding quality that it has that I think is admirable is that it takes him seriously. This is not just about somebody who was a big bestseller and had movies made from his books, etc. It's about a serious writer who is serious about his craft. It's almost monastic, the life that he leads. And it's fascinating, if you are a writer or involved in this world, to see descriptions of, you know, drafts that are thrown away and the rewriting and the search for titles. And we just always assume that things magically appear out of a hat.
Was there sort of one kind of fun fact that you came across?
Only in the sense that the titles, many of which I can't remember to tell you the truth, but they just seem so clunky and you think, ouch, you know, whoever thought of that?
Right.
Which isn't to say that all titles are perfect in the end, you know, but I think that we always assume that once it's on the book, that was always the title.
Was Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy always the title?
Yeah, that one he always had. But for instance, Little Drummer Girl, I think there were 8 or 9 alternatives. A Perfect Spy, I think, was at the very end. It was Bob Gottlieb at Knopf who came up with this. Victor Golans, again, the first British publisher, is the one who invented this, who came up with the title, The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. He took it from a line in the book where someone says, we can't just leave him out there in the cold. But nevertheless, it was Victor who said, why don't we call it this?
So knowing that Le Carré is going to be writing his own memoir, which is supposed to be out next year, what are you left after reading this biography wanting to know?
I want to know how he feels about his mother. I think that's a really interesting part of this. I mean, we know how he feels about the father, and this is a real love-hate relationship, because the father is, as I say at one point in the review, fabulous copy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he may have been a bad guy and not necessarily a great dad, but he's a tremendous character and, you know, swindling people. And at one point, he's proposing this whole building scheme in Toronto, and it turns out he doesn't own the land and he has no, you know, it's just all a scam. I think that Le Carré is struggling with this all during his childhood and into his adulthood. The minute he becomes a great success, Ronnie, the father, capitalizes on this. He puts out cards saying, I'm the father of John Le Carré.
He would sign books.
He would sign
so
books.
Crazy.
I mean, he ran into somebody in Hong Kong and started signing from the father of the author. So he was intrusive. He took a lot of credit for this. I think my favorite detail, and maybe I'd like to know a little more about that, is that he sues or threatens to sue Le Carré at one point because one of the characters in the books is so clearly based on him. Le Carré pays him $14,000 to drop the suit. You know? So he's actually being blackmailed by his own father.
Let's turn briefly to the other book in your review, Frederick Forsyth's memoir, The Outsider, My Life in Intrigue. A very different book. Tell us about that.
Very different book. This is Forsyth having a good time.
Mm-hmm.
It's very anecdotal. It's, and I did this, and then I did this, and it's derring do. It is certainly not, as the Le Carré biography is, a search for the soul or, you know, what prompts those dark nights when you are thinking about the moral ambiguities that mm-hmm. are going to go into the work. Forsyth is much more straightforward and blither, and he's, you know, they're 10 years apart. They had quite similar commercial experiences. They both had an early breakthrough book. In Forsyth's case, it's Day of the Jackal, which he follows up with The Odessa File. And Day of the Jackal is a really interesting thriller because it's, as you know, about an attempted assassination of de Gaulle. But we already know the end,
right?
Because de Gaulle is alive when this book is published. So we know that it's going to fail. And the whole thriller aspect is, how do they catch these guys? And how is it set up? How do they do it? So in that, in a technical way, it's sort of a remarkable book. But Forsyth is he was a happy kid who wanted an adventurous life. I mean, he became an RAF pilot when he was 17, apparently the youngest person ever to do so. He wanted to be a foreign correspondent, not because he was interested in writing, but he was interested in seeing the world, and he thought this would be a job that would get him out and do it, as indeed it did.
Right.
And Reuters, I think, sent him to Paris, and then he worked for the BBC in Nigeria and Biafra. He worked for someone else in East Berlin. He was there for about a year.
But he was never a spy.
And he would do what he calls enhanced tourism.
Mm-hmm.
He would be asked to report on various things, and particularly after he became a novelist, because the idea of traveling around and doing, quote, research for his novels was a perfect cover.
Mm-hmm.
So indeed, he was involved in derring do's, you know, and these exploits, all of which he likes to tell. The metaphor I use in the review is that this is like being in a pub with somebody who wants to tell you stories, and you know you have better things to do and worthier things to do, but he's so charming and he keeps refilling your glass, and before you know it, you've had a very pleasant evening. You know, I think the book is like that. It's light, it's not without substance, and if you're interested in this kind of life, it's a, you know, it's a terrific read, but it's not as seriously intended.
Mm-hmm.
As the Le Carré biography is.
Okay, the books again are The Outsider, My Life in Intrigue by Frederick Forsyth, and John Le Carré, the biography by Adam Sisman, both reviewed this week by Joseph Cannon, himself a novelist of many acclaimed espionage thrillers. Joe, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure.
John Williams joins us now to represent our listeners and readers. Hi, John.
Hey, Pamela.
What did we ask people this week?
Since Halloween is this weekend, we asked people for their favorite scary book.
Ooh, okay.
And I realized in reading all of their answers that I don't really read scary books.
You scared?
I'm not too scared. I just never got into horror. But these are some good places to start. We did not specify that people couldn't answer Stephen King. So about 60% of people probably named a Stephen King book. Lots of different ones, though. Holly Smith named Pet Sematary. Julie Wright named Night Shift. She said that King's early writing was filled with some great ideas. Each short story is incredible. Andrea named King's Misery, but said Cujo was great, too.
I thought Misery was like it was terrifying in a very different kind of way.
Yes, it was. And I saw that movie. I do. The Shining is, I think, the scariest movie probably ever. But I know people, very tough people, who read the book and couldn't sleep. So I'm a little afraid of the book.
That's my scariest Stephen King nomination.
It seems even creepier than the movie, which is saying something. Elizabeth Brumbaugh named It by Stephen King. But moving into the non-King category, Jack Martin said that dystopian tales of plausible futures are what terrify him, including The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood and Michelle Welbeck's recent submission. He said, ghosts don't scare me, these do. Several readers named Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None, Mark Z. Danielewski's House of Leaves, and The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson, which is an old classic.
Ooh, that is a good creepy one.
And going even further back in time to something I had not heard of, a reader named Colin Harker said the Irish novelist Charles Robert Maturin's Melmoth the Wanderer from 1820, a classic Gothic, and he actually put up a little image of one of the pages on Twitter, and it did seem pretty terrifying.
You know, one of the scariest books I read last year was a children's book by the Argentinian cartoonist Liniers, who was profiled this week in The Times, called What There Is Before There Is Anything There. If you really want to scare yourself or terrify a small child, I would highly recommend that.
Well, I'm going to go terrify a small child with it.
All right. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Pamela.
Happy Halloween.
You too.
Greg Coles is here now with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new?
Well, they're top heavy on the fiction side this week, where there are four new titles and they're all in the top six. So four of the top six fiction bestsellers are new to the list this week, starting with number six. The Australian author Kate Morton has a new novel, The Lake House. This is not her first time on the list, but this book is not set in Australia. It's set in England. It's a historical mystery set in 1930s Cornwall, England. Then at number four, Joseph Fink and Jeffrey Craner, who together are the team behind the hit podcast Welcome to Night Vale, have a debut novel also called Welcome to Night Vale. It's kind of a desert gothic. It's set in the southwestern desert about mysterious happenings in the town of Night Vale there. Then at number three, Robert Galbraith, and I'm putting air quotes around that because it's actually, of course, J.K. Rowling, has her third Robert Galbraith mystery novel called Career of Evil. That's part of the Cormoran Strike Robert Galbraith series. And finally, new at number one, our old friend John Grisham has a new book out called Rogue Lawyer. It's kind of a change of direction for him. It's sort of like Michael Connelly's Lincoln Lawyer or like Saul Goodman from Better Call Saul. The main character is a rogue lawyer who lives out of his car, or works out of his car, rather, and takes on kind of the lowest of the low defendants and uses any means necessary to get them off.
I feel like that leads us right into nonfiction.
Sure, it leads us right into nonfiction. There are four new titles on the nonfiction list, starting down at number 15. Sarah Vowell, who of course made her name as an essayist on This American Life, but has since branched out to quirky, kind of in-depth, but aslant explorations of American history, has a new book in that vein called Lafayette in the Somewhat United States, and it's looking at the American Revolution.
To me, she's still Violet in The Incredibles.
Up at number 12, the ESPN analyst Ray Lewis, who to me is still one of the great all-time middle linebackers. He played that position his whole career for the Baltimore Ravens, where he was not an uncontroversial figure. He was involved, or he was on the scene, rather, when two men were killed after the Super Bowl party in 2000. He has written a memoir called I Feel Like Going On with a guy named Daniel Paisner, who's ghostwritten for a lot of athletes and pop culture figures and politicians, including maybe most notably these days, John Kasich's memoir. John Kasich, of course, the Ohio governor who is now running for the Republican nomination for president. Then up at number nine, a book called Extreme Ownership by Jocko Willink and Leif Babin. Jocko Willink is a former Navy SEAL. Tim Ferriss, the guy from the 4-Hour Workweek, recently called him the scariest Navy SEAL imaginable. And Extreme Ownership is his guide on how to apply Navy SEAL wisdom to leadership in general. And then finally, all the way up at number two.
I'm just kind of curious about what makes Tim Ferriss an expert on Navy SEALs, but we'll just skip over that.
Scary Navy SEALs. Yeah. Apparently, they have mutual friends.
All right.
Then up at number two, Tyler Oakley, who has made a name for himself as a YouTube personality and sort of a social advocate, especially in the LGBTQ world as an advocate and activist in that world, has written a collection of personal essays called Binge, and that makes its debut at number two.
I'm still a little uncomfortable with the job title, YouTube personality.
And yet, it's kind of the going thing in publishing these days. Over on the young adult list, there are not one but two books written by YouTube personalities.
Well, I guess maybe we should be YouTube personalities in our next lives.
All right. One day.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.